What's going on with the cricket?
Well, that's what the ABC Cricket Podcast is for. Who's been selected, who's been rejected, and who has the best grade cricket salad roll? Search for ABC Cricket Podcast on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Mark Winterbottom grew up in outer western Sydney. Both his mum and his dad had participated in motorsports. And by an extraordinary stroke of luck, Mark got his first mini motorbike at the age of 8. And then he was off, tearing down the track as fast as the little thing would carry him. But the family was not rich, and motorsport is a rich person's game. So there had to be some serious sacrifices made to keep him on the track. Nonetheless, Mark rose up from bikes to kart racing and then to V8 supercars. He won race after race, but for Mark, the mountain that he had to climb was literally a mountain. The Bathurst 1000 at Mount Panorama. For years, Mark duelled with his great rival, Jamie Wincup, but had to watch him take the winner's spot on the podium while Mark fell short for all kinds of different reasons. But then in 2013, after 6 hours roaring around the track, in the final lap of the race, the two of them went bumper to bumper, fighting for first place in an electrifying finish. Mark Winterbottom's very entertaining biography takes its title from his racing nickname, Frosty. Hello, Mark.
Hello, mate.
When you're getting ready to begin at Bathurst, what kind of preparation does a driver like you need to do before you actually climb into the car?
Well, honestly, to prepare for Bathurst, you drive out of a year, a race, a weekend, and on the way home, you're already preparing for 12 months' time. It's an unbelievable place because you've got to learn from the mistakes that were made on the day. So my Bathurst preparation will always start on the drive home, which is 9 hours from Bathurst to Melbourne, and a lot of time to think and digest. But in that 12 months, you're obviously going over the personnel that you need to win the race. We're looking at what co-driver you need. And then when it gets closer to the event, you run over data, you look at setups, you look at footage to see what your competitors have done right. And then you start the mental prep and the physical prep, because Bathurst, surprisingly, is more mental than physical. It's a very mentally tough weekend, let alone just one race. It goes from Tuesday all the way through to Sundays, and food preparation, nutrition. So there's so much that goes on just to get ready for that race. And that's why when you do win it, you're one car out of 26 that has the amazing, perfect story. And the other 25 sort of lick their wounds on the way home and try and work out what they did wrong. It's a very tough place to get right.
All sports are very competitive, but motor racing, you guys are really, really looking out for one another. How carefully do you study your rivals before you go into Bathurst?
Well, I do it two ways. I look at the rivals to see strengths, weaknesses, because when you're in the heat of the moment, you want to know what they're going to do, where they're strong, where they're weak, are they aggressive, where have they made moves previously to pass cars on the track and all that sort of stuff. So you want to make sure when that one opportunity comes, like 2013 on the last lap, I know exactly where to put my car. I don't want to be thinking about the process. I want it to become natural. So I look at all that side, but you have to focus on yourself and the team, because if you get drawn into other people, you can lose focus of what you do well. So it's that fine balance. You've got to not get too drawn into it, but know enough about your competitors. You don't get passed, you don't get jumped, you don't get beat. So it's a two-part sort of preparation. It's very strange motorsport, but you have to focus on them and you have to focus on yourself. And if you do both right, end of the day, you should be somewhere around the podium, which is why we go racing.
Just before the start of the race, this is one of the most exciting moments, I think, in any kind of sport. But at Bathurst, I've been there twice when I was a kid, and it's the loudest thing I've ever heard in my life, and you're right in the middle of it there. What state are you in emotionally as you're in the car, lined up, getting ready to go, waiting for the lights to change? Are you in a hyper-aggressive, like, let's do this sort of thing, or are you as cool as an astronaut in that moment?
I'm actually quite cool, and it's funny. You have to be very calm and collected in the race car, because I'm very process-driven. So before the grid, the nerves are up. You get the butterflies. You've got that, come on, let's go do it. But something, when I put that helmet on, it's a trigger that puts me in my sort of comfort special place. And when I drive around to the grid and you're pulling up, you know, and especially when you're on pole position, you're the first car to pull up, all eyes are on the front of the grid. It can be a minute before the last car forms up. So there's a minute of just dead silence that you're sitting in the car, but I'll go through processes. I'll put the gear into neutral. I'll scroll through the screen on my page. I'll do a process of things that sort of subconsciously keep me calm. And then my radio communication will start. Last car's forming up, green flag, 5 seconds. And they're all triggers for me. It's when the process goes wrong and something happens, then you start to scramble and the heart rate goes up. So thankfully, out of the 22 years I've been to Bathurst, I reckon 21 of them have gone process-driven perfect and only one has gone a bit pear-shaped. But it's all about controlling the nerves, stay calm and make smart decisions, because under stress, we're prone to make mistakes. So it's about staying calm.
Bathurst is an endurance race. It's going to last for roughly 6 hours. So right at the start, your car is weighed down by a massive amount of fuel. Is it a bit like having a boot full of luggage to start off with?
Yeah, it is. We carry 111 litres of fuel, so that's about 120 kilograms of fuel in the back of the car. So, yeah, it's heavy, and it's about a second a lap slower when you carry that much fuel. So you can feel it when you're in the car and you're in sync with the car. You can feel the weight. It's a bit pendulum-like where the weight transfers, it's a bit slow, it's a bit sloppy and heavy. And then as the fuel burns off, we'll go through a full tank in 22, 23 laps. And you'll see down the straights, you pick up speed, your kilometres an hour are faster. It's just starting to feel nice. And then they pit you and put more fuel in again and you go again. So you sort of repeat the cycle.
But right. And you're just starting to have a great time and then you've got to pull in.
Yeah, and then you pull in and go again. But that's where some guys are very strong on full tanks of fuel. Some guys are very strong on low tanks of fuel. And this is where strategy comes into it. Do I want a car that's strong at the start of the race? Do I want a car that's strong at the end of the race? So again, all this strategy planning comes into play.
So then as you're waiting for the race to start, the cars are all revving. It's this massive noise. It's very, very exciting. Can you just take me through those seconds up to the lights changing and then what happens when the lights change?
It's funny. From outside the car, it's very noisy. From inside the car, it's a sense of silence. It's very bizarre. You wait for all the cars to form up. You'll get a green flag. They'll say, you know, green flag, 5 seconds. And you'll see the starter on the starter's box. He puts a 5 second board out. That's a 5 second countdown to when the lights go red. And so you've got 5 seconds there. You pull gear. You're finding your clutch position. You're doing all that process. And then the lights will come on red. And they can go out between 3 and 5 seconds. So they don't do the same time every time, so you don't predict it. So you're sitting there just waiting for the red light to go out. And it happens very quickly, but it all happens very quietly. It's bizarre because you're so focused on the flick of the light going out, you forget the whole world exists. It's a really strange feeling. But as soon as you launch and the light goes out and you launch, you know I've got a really good start, or, oh my goodness, I'm vulnerable. And then you start looking at the mirrors about protection mode. It is a scramble, but like I said, when everything goes perfect, it all happens in slow motion. It happens really nice. It's calm. It's under control. But when you wheel spin or the car bogs, you feel like a surfer and a pack of sharks. They're just around you and you just feel vulnerable. You're scrambling, just trying to hope that they don't clean you up.
And then you've only just started the race and you're going to be in that thing for 6 hours.
They tell you 161 laps to go, which is quite demoralising. When you come out of turn one, you've lost a couple of positions. You know it's a long day. 161 laps, 6.2 kilometres, 1,000 kilometres of race ahead of you. It's a really long day, and 6 hours is the record. So with safety cars, it can be 7 hours, can be 7.5 hours. So
you're sitting in this suit that's going to protect you against fire, and you're wearing a helmet, and you're in this vehicle, and there absolutely cannot be air conditioning because that's going to weigh you down. And I think your windows have to be up too for aerodynamic reasons, isn't that right? So you're going to get very, very hot in that car, aren't you?
You do. You get very hot. So inside the car is about 30 degrees warmer than ambient. So we go to Darwin, 45 degrees, 40 degrees outside. It's 70 to 75 in the cabin. So
How can you survive that? Can human beings survive in those conditions?
I mean, adrenaline. It's adrenaline. And we run a cool suit, which is... It's a great Australian invention, to be honest. It's a T-shirt with capillary tubes on it. It goes into an esky. It's an engineered esky, but it has dry ice and it rotates cold water out, hot water in. It's on your body, so it keeps your body cool. But Other than that, we have a little hole in the window, which is incentive to go faster because that blows, the faster you go, the more air blows in the car. But it's hot. Like, we'll lose at Bathurst 3 kilograms over the day. So it's very hot, very physical.
As I said, both your mum and your dad had been involved in motorsport before you were born. What kind of involvement did they have?
My dad raced speedway, so he was a two-time Australian sprint car champion, so he raced on dirt. And my mum raced a Mini Cooper S in time trials and was very quick, and she was very good on the track. There was a place in Sydney years ago called the Village Grand Prix, and she held the lap record there. So she was, in her own right, very fast on track as well. So, yeah, a racing background, but two different. One was circuit racing and one was on dirt.
Nonetheless, you say they were an unlikely pair. Is that because they were temperamentally different?
They were very different people, to be honest. Mum was very loving, affectionate, which kind of goes against how she drove the car, because she was quite aggressive in the car and not very calculated. But my dad was sort of unaffectionate, went to work, emotionally disconnected, I guess, towards us as kids, but very calculated and calm in the car. So it's funny that the traits they had outside the car probably were different to what you saw when they drove the cars.
Tell me about your earliest memory of being taken to Mount Panorama as a very little boy.
Yeah, my first memory, I went to Bathurst in a Nissan Bluebird of all cars, which you don't go to Bathurst. You go to Bathurst in a Ford or you go in a Holden. Nissans weren't very well liked. So
I think we might have driven there in a Sigma, in a Mitsubishi Sigma back in the day. I was a bit embarrassed about that.
Well, they're cool again. They've come cool again. They're very cool cars. But yeah, we used to live in Blacktown or Doonside, which the Bells line of road, if you're in Sydney, it's that windy road to get to Bathurst. So I used to get car sick because I remember first trip to Bathurst, Nissan Bluebird, side of the road, just short of Lithgow. Yeah, not feeling very good. By the time we got to Bathurst, I think it was a three-hour trip, should have taken 2 hours or an hour and 45. But yeah, just remember rolling into Bathurst, just being blown away at how big it was, how steep it was, just the atmosphere, everything about it. It was really cool. But Bathurst wasn't that kind to me. Actually, we went up on Saturday. We planned to stay for a couple of days. My dad told me to get something out the boot of the car. I did. I burnt my knee. Mum and Dad fought, and we drove home about 2 hours later from Bathurst with, a scar on the leg. So first Bathurst was an eye-opener for many reasons, but I remember I'd be going back. It was just one of those places. It was just awesome getting there, seeing the cars, seeing the people. It was very addictive. I knew from an early age I'd be back at that place at some stage.
You were very close to your mum. You write really beautifully about that. At a young age, about 1985, you became aware that your mum was ill. How did you become aware that things were not travelling well with her?
Yeah, my mum, she was an amazing lady and one of the most special people I've had in my life. She was very close to both my sister and myself, and she used to talk to us. She didn't hide stuff from us, which was probably why we were very close, because it was always an open book. I knew she could tell me anything, and I always felt comfortable that I could tell her anything, whether good, bad, whatever it was. So, yeah, she told us very early that she had breast cancer and was in a bad way. So I kind of, because I think Dad was emotionally disconnected a bit, she was very close with my sister and I, so she used us as her support network to go with her to visits and appointments. And good news was great trips, bad news was really sad trips on the way home on the train from the city. So, yeah, we're involved from a young age, but she always told us. She never hid anything from us, and that was nice because, you know, when your parents are not natural and normal and something's up, but if they don't tell you, you go into speculation mode. So she was always very open and we always knew.
Do you think that's had some long-term effects on you?
It was normal to me when I was young because that's all I knew. But, yeah, it does, because I think emotionally it's tough because, you know, through life I think you shut people out a little bit because some problems that people have don't seem big enough to me, to be honest, to what I'd gone through. So if someone would say, hey, it's cold outside, it's wet, oh, I'm freezing, I'd be like, really? Like, what I've dealt with, that's not a big drama. So I probably saw things in people that the upbringing may have turned off an emotional connection somewhere there. But on the flip side, I think from my racing career, it kind of helped me in some way because when I was under pressure or on the start line or some of the big moments, I didn't feel like they were bigger moments than what I'd been through as a kid. There was good things that come from it, and there was definitely bad things that come from it. But end of the day, when your mum needs help, you're there, you know, you have to be there. And it's a bit sad for her to go through it by herself. And that's just what wasn't meant to happen, I guess, when I was young, to be there for support.
It sounds like you can calibrate how bad things can be in your head by measuring against that or any other thing else, anything else in your head. I wonder, you know, there's a kind of degree of control to motor racing, as you say, but a fair bit of madness as well. I wonder if that helps you keep perspective.
It does. And not only just going through that, like my mum, she was a fighter. Like at the age of 38, I think it was 37, she got told she'd have maybe a year or two to live. And she lived till she was 63. So she fought for a long time. So I think, you know, growing up in a non-financially strong family, seeing your parents' work ethic and the way they fought was pretty amazing as well. So I've been really lucky that to groom the person you are, I was never handed everything. You had to fight pretty hard to get what you wanted. And when you see mum in hospital, you know, fighting what she was fighting and going through all that process, when you're on track, it does make you a pretty strong-minded person and quite resilient. So you definitely draw inspiration from things like that. And I think that's important. You know, we go through trauma, and that's why when I wrote the book, I went into detail, because a lot of people deal with this and they don't know how to talk about it. And I was one of them. But when you start writing it down, it's quite therapeutic to get it out there and realize that lots of people are going through it and can relate to it. So yeah, I felt really nice writing it down and just getting it out of the system was a good feeling.
There's a whole lot of rotten luck in that with the situation with your mum, but then there's this moment of great good luck for you. At the age of 8, you have this kind of golden moment that takes place in a shopping centre when your future is revealed to you in a raffle. Tell me how that unfolded for you, Mark.
Well, I realised at a young age, to get what you want, you lie on the ground and you cry. That's what you do as a kid. In the middle of the shopping centre, you cause a scene.
I still do it now.
I wish we could. I'd win a lot more races if I could do that. But I realised very young, and when we went to Woodcroft near Doonside at the local Coles shopping centre, there was a raffle and there was all these prizes, but in the middle sat this shiny red and white Peewee 50. I don't remember the other prizes. I just remember the motorbike, and I ran up, sat on it, you know, blipped the throttle, and just, I was riding. I'm like, righto, $2 raffle ticket, mum, $2 will buy a bike. Like, I want this. And she didn't want to let me down harsh and say that it's 1 in a million type chance. It's not $2 for the bike, it's $2 for the ticket. So she said, let me think about it. And then that's what I went in the supermarket, got the tantrum, started doing all that side, and then I walk out and bang, we've got a ticket. So, but deep down, you just sometimes know that, I don't know if it's because you want it so badly, but I knew I was going to win that bike, and I don't know why, but I said to mum, we're going to win this bike, just buy me the ticket, I know we're going to win it.
Are you waiting for the phone call, are you then?
Waiting for the phone call, and it took 2 weeks. So every time the phone rang, I'd say, mum, is that my bike? And she'd, no, sweetheart, no, let you down gently. But after 2 weeks, the phone call did come through and, yeah, we won the motorbike. It was pretty amazing because think of the chances, 1 in a million. And honestly, without that bike, my motorsport career doesn't kick off, because you needed an injection of something to, one, show your craft, and two, have some financial, you know, asset that you could go and use for racing. So that kick-started everything.
Pretty quickly, you start doing motocross racing. What, at the age of 8? That's extraordinary. How well did you take to motocross racing at that age?
Well, I thought I struggled. Like, I thought it was tough. And on motorbikes, to go faster, your body's on the line. Like, it's effectively, you want to go faster, there's a chance of falling off. And you fall off, you're going to get hurt. But I was going okay. I was winning at club level. And then we went and raced at the Nationals. And there was a guy there who was very good. And I had, at the age of 8, 9, 10, you have no idea what names are. They're just another person on a bike with a helmet. And I used to finish second to him, and he'd win by half a lap. And one day I thought, oh my goodness, I'm going to win this. I'm going out. I don't care. Body on the line. I'm going to win. And I led the race, and I led for half a lap. And through the whoop section, I normally use third gear. I was in fourth or fifth gear, trying to just do something that was far beyond my capabilities, and crashed, hit the fence, half knocked myself out, and that was it. But the guy that was always winning turns out to be Chad Reed, who went on to win the World Motocross Championship, I think, 3 years in a row. So I'm probably not as bad as I thought I was, but tough era. That was a tough kid to go up against.
Well, once you crashed, what did your mum say about that?
It's done. Like, it was done, because she didn't wrap us up in bubble wrap, but she got pretty close to it. You know, it was always, as soon as you get hurt, as soon as you start riding and doing stupid things, you finish. And that was probably ticking all those boxes, to be fair. So it was done. And then we went home and I said to Mum, okay, well, if I'm not racing bikes, I want to race something because I love it. Back then, the Trading Post, which was the glorified, I guess now it's Marketplace on Facebook, there was an advert in the Trading Post. You'd sit down, you'd open it every Thursday, we'd read it saying, swap motorbike for a go-kart. And that lit up and made the phone call. And they said, yep, righto, we want a motorbike. We want to get rid of this go-kart. And it was $0 handover, so we could hand over for free. And we drove to Lithgow, and an hour and a half later, we didn't have a motorbike anymore and we had a go-kart.
When you're racing in a go-kart, you're much closer to the ground, aren't you? And therefore, as you're going along at high speed, the ground is rushing up towards you in a much more dramatic way. Did you like that, the drama of that?
I loved it. The karting felt natural straight away. Four wheels, steering wheel. I guess you drive from your backside. You can kind of feel the kart. I felt very connected with it straight away. It felt normal. And with a motorbike, it's always on edge. You're in the air. If you don't commit, you get punished. If you commit too hard, you get punished. It was very tough. The motorbike was very tough. So I really liked the go-kart. It was 100 kilometres an hour, so still very fast, but I felt in control. It felt natural. In my first race, I had a really good result, and I knew straight away that it was a lot more natural for me than the motorbike.
So you started claiming all these titles. Then you claimed your first national title, beating a young Jamie Wincup. When you did that, did you look at him and think, my nemesis at last?
Not really. It's funny, because I was New South Wales and they were Victorian, you kind of rocked up to their turf, depending on where we raced, and it was, well, I'm not going to let a New South Welshman beat me on my home turf. Or they'd come to you and you'd write, no Victorian's going to beat me here. But he was not on my radar to be a 35-year rival. But karting was good. We definitely had the upper hand on him through those years, which was nice. But it was a rivalry that went on for, yeah, like I said, 30-plus years.
How did you then make the transition to racing cars as opposed to racing karts?
It's very tough. You know, in karting, I won 10 Australian titles and whatever it was, 25 state titles. So you like the big fish in the small pond. But to make that next step, unless you've got a big fat checkbook or sponsor, there's just no avenue to get in. So in the final year of karting, I went all in. It was either win or bust. And there was a championship sponsored by the Ford Motor Company. And it was $15,000 to enter. And to win it, you get a $160,000 Formula Ford scholarship to go car racing. So for me, $15,000, I think I had about $500 in my bank. So I went to the bank and got a $15,000 loan. I took out a Trading Post cutout of a Mitsubishi Lancer and said to the bank manager that I'm buying a car, can I have $15,000? And back then they gave it to you a lot easier than they do now. But done. This is the repayments. This is the terms. This is it. Can you afford it? Yep, I can afford it. And handed over $15,000, went down and bought the go-kart and did the championship. And in the final round, I was leading by 2 points. And this is where, I guess, that mental, resilient, tough upbringing really worked in my favour, because I had to get into the mind of the guy I was racing, because it was win or bust. If I win, I get the scholarship. If I lose, I've got a $15,000 debt and I've got to try and start my life.
Oh, this is everything on the line then, really?
Everything. And this was it. I was done. I was out of money. I needed to get a job, a real job, not a karting job. So all these factors. So it was win or bust. So to me, it was get into this guy's mind, do whatever it has to win it. And thankfully, last race, got the job done, finished first, and got the scholarship. And that was the ticket to the Ford Motor Company and into Formula Ford.
You'd been pretty serious about racing as a teenager. Did that sort of crowd out time for normal teenage activities?
Well, most of the kids at weekends would go to parties. I was racing. If I wasn't racing, I was in the garage servicing my cart, or I had a little business. I'd make modifications to carburetors and sell it. And that was funding my racing. And so I was doing things to just make sure I kept driving. And literally, you'd rock up Monday at school and all my mates, they were really supportive. They were good, really good guys. But you were disconnected from the parties, which kept you on the straight and narrow. But you definitely miss. You have to make sacrifice because if you don't, you don't make it. It's you have to go all in. And definitely, yeah, you do miss things.
It was around this time you met your wife, Renee. What impression did she make when you first caught sight of Renee?
She was very impressive. She was very beautiful. She still is. But I met her at the go-kart track and her brother raced. So she had an interest. She used to, instead of, you know, some of the girls would sit at the canteen or be on their phones. She was on working on the cart, helping her brother and was very involved. And I was attracted to her straight away. So
did she have grease on her hands?
She had grease on her hands. Wow. She's not afraid to work. She's a worker. And I thought, if I get a good result and I walk around and stride a bit, maybe she'll she'll notice me. But yeah, very lucky. So we met very early and she's been a big part of my career all the way through because she understood racing. It's not like she jumped on board when you're already racing or she's been there from day one. She's ridden the journey together. She's got a Bachelor of Business, so she's very clever. She's done all my contracts. She's done all my managing. She's been a big part of it as well. So I was very lucky. We met at a young age and we're still best friends today and we have a lot in common. We have three beautiful kids and she's still a beautiful woman that I met many years ago.
21, you signed with Stone Brothers Racing, a V8 Supercars partnership, and moved to Queensland. Was this your first time living away from home when you had to do that?
Yeah, it was. And it was really tough. I remember driving out of home at Doonside, 21 years old, and I loaded all my possessions, which wasn't much, to be fair. I think I had a pillow and a doona and some clothes and a race helmet and a couple of things. So I didn't really have a lot of stuff. But I remember Mum waving as I was driving down the street. It was really sad. It was really sad to leave home, but such a good opportunity to get into supercars. And I was really lucky too because Ross Stone, who was one of the owners of Stone Brothers, took me into his house and they looked after me like I was one of their own. But I felt homesick. You know, I was going to work. I was sweeping the floors. I had to earn my way when I was there. It wasn't just a driver where you rock up and where's the track, what's the lap record and go home. It was work, earn your way. I was rubbing down cars, sanding them to get prepped for painting. I was running around picking up parts. So it was tough. It was a bit of an initiation from a mummy's boy going to work and leaving home and thrown into the real world, but awesome opportunity.
This is the first time you were put inside a V8 supercar. How different is a V8 supercar to, I don't know, a V8 road car?
Very different. I felt out of my depth. The first time I jumped in it, I thought, this thing's got way too much horsepower. It's hot. I can't see my wheels. It's heavy. It doesn't stop that well. It's wheel spinning in fourth or fifth gear. Like, what have I signed up for? What is this thing that I've jumped into? There's no luxury, you know. They're built for speed. They're not built for comfort. They're a race seat with all these control panels around you. There's leg protection. There's steering wheel. There's everything. And you're in this little, it's almost like a little cockpit that you sit in and the rest of the car doesn't exist. Where in the road car, you sit there and, you know, you've got your luxury, you've got your carpet, you've got your radio, all the mod cons that come with it. So yeah, felt very claustrophobic at first, felt very fast.
It's all stripped back, but it's a kind of a rocket, isn't it? I just wonder what the G-forces are like when you launch yourself and then when you turn a corner and when you brake, how powerfully you feel those pressing G-forces on your body.
Surprisingly, a go-kart feels more G-force. Where the supercar felt, there's a big race seat, it's wrapped around your head, it's got suspension, it's got power steering. It felt a lot different from a G-force point of view. It actually felt very physically easy in that side on your neck and all those areas, but the actual brake pedal, you know, the force that you've got to make to stop the car, we've got to do 90 kilograms, 100 kilogram leg press to stop a car with brake pressure. So all those forces, when you pull a gear change, it was 40 kilograms on a seated row machine, equivalent one arm to pull a gear. So those were the forces that blew me away. Not the G-force, but the force to drive the car physically was mind-blowing.
You write that despite your doubts in your first race, you won pole position and you won the race easily. But then that was followed by a reverse grid race where you started at the back of the pack and you had to overtake everyone. This seems to be like one of the most crucial skills you have to have in motor racing. Can you just break down the fundamentals of overtaking a rival on the turn? What are you calibrating in your mind as you're roaring up behind this person?
Yeah, it's something that happens naturally. It's very hard to teach. But for me, I look at the competition and you've got to bite your time a little bit because you want to get someone very quickly and you get to them and you want to pass them straight away. But sometimes you have to be patient, wait a lap or whatever it is. And that's what I found my strength has been, because if you're desperate, aggressive, you'll make the wrong decision and it's game over. So, and I think that comes from always having to pay for bits myself because I know how expensive it is. So from a young age, I had to be very calculated because if I tore up too much equipment, I couldn't race because I couldn't afford to fix things. So when I followed in a supercar, I would watch them. I'd see where they're weak. You'd see where they break. Do they turn under brakes? Are they moving under brakes? Are they vulnerable here? And then you'd attack. And when you do attack, you've got to be very forceful because you've got to commit to a pass when you make a pass. So always be calculated. And that's always something that's gone through my head. The first race in a supercar was very tough, but I had a engineer called Kemba Little, one of the greatest engineers we've seen in our sport, who passed away last year. He was on my radio and he was coaching me as well. He was rudder, control, attack, going through the whole process. So although it happens naturally, he was trying to guide me as well at the same time. But it's an art. It's a very fine art to pass.
If you're going to overtake on a turn, that means, I suppose, you have to pour on the speed for a very short while as you're going into the turn, which is what you don't normally do when you're driving on the road, do you? What happens then once you've poured on the speed in an attempt to overtake on a turn?
Well, you've got to outbrake someone. And this is the hard part because, say, we do 300 kilometres an hour down Conrod Strait. We go into the chase, which is the corner after Conrod Strait, and we brake at about the 160 metre marker. We go through the gearbox, fifth, fourth, third, second, and we'll slow the car down to 120 kilometres. So to pass someone, if they're braking at 160, where you brake on your normal race line every lap, that's your maximum. You've got to pass someone and brake at 150 to get the pass done on that person. So you've got to go deeper than you've done previous laps. You've got to do it on the non-race line. Effectively, you've got to take that corner away from that person you're trying to pass. It's often done under brake. So that's where everything happens fast, but you've got to try and make it happen slow in your mind so you're in control and you can sort of foresight what's going to happen. So that's rule 101 of a pass. Brake deeper, pull the car up, take the corner away from the person you're racing.
And this is an engine brake you're talking about, like using shifting down on the stick? Is that what you're doing?
Shifting down, braking with the brake pedal and the gearbox to slow. Try not to compression lock the rear. Try not to lock the front tyre. Going through all that process, if you get it right, sort of stop the guy on the outside to make sure he doesn't switch you and pass you on the exit. It's an art, and that's why if you crash a lot, they don't renew your contract because you become expensive. But if you don't pass enough and you stay behind someone, you become the soft driver and you don't get the contract. So it's that fine line of aggression, controlled aggression.
2003, you're there at Bathurst, the starting line for the Bathurst 1000. You're pushing your way into eighth place and then something went badly wrong. Tell me how that unfolded.
Well, first year at Bathurst, I was hitting everyone to pass them. So this was controlled aggression gone wrong. It was just aggression without the control. I think the moment got the better of me.
When you say hitting them, do you mean like bumping them? You mean
when I was passing them, right. I was pushing them out of the way to pass them, right. Which I was told very clearly not to do because you win at the end. If you have damage, you carry that all the way through the race. So in the first stint, I drove from, I think I was like 14th, and I drove through to 8th or 7th or whatever it was. And the safety car came out. My engineer got on the radio and said, just do us a favour, go and hit the safety car because it's the only car you haven't hit this whole race. So
this is the safety car, is the car that comes on when there's a prang and they've got to come and tow the or help the car get off and help the driver escape. That's pretty much, isn't it?
The car that's your friend that he just literally said go and hit because it's the only one you haven't hit. So, but I thought I was on fire. I thought, oh my goodness, I've passed all these superstars. I'm up to 8th and 7th and I'm amazing. I come in and he just absolutely tore into me about how, you know, you've got to be controlled aggression. So, but we were going okay. We got all the way up to third on track, catching the guy in second on lap 102. So what's that, 59 laps to go, 60 laps to go. And the engine failed at the top of the mountain and it was game over. So Bathurst was cruel. It was a great first experience until lap 102. Could have podiumed potentially on the first one, which is probably good I didn't, because it teaches you how tough it is to get a result at that place. If you had got one on the first one, I don't think it would have been as rewarding as having to fight for it over the years.
You spent a couple of unhappy years after that with Lycombe Motorsport, and you say when it comes to teammates within the group, there's always going to be some coolness, I mean, civility, but coolness and a degree of tension between the teammates within the group. Why is that?
Well, end of the day, you're in the same equipment, so there's no obligation for a teammate to help you. That's sort of motorsport. We see in Formula One, like at the moment, Piastri and Norris, everyone's very friendly, but deep down there's an agenda. And in motorsport, it's very much you get judged against your teammates. So like a motorsport, very tough. The first year or two, it was very grateful for the opportunity to get in. But the team's focus was with Jason Barguana, who was the teammate at the time. He was the main guy, sort of in his prime years, and was leading the team. But yeah, he definitely didn't play as the teammate that I probably needed when I was young, because I was still learning. I was very young, first year, very raw. But he was on a mission, obviously, for himself, which is fair enough. And yeah, it was tough. It was a very tough couple of years to go from winning the Super 2 Championship with the team that was the best in the business to a team that was underfunded for two cars, under-supported, and I was massively inexperienced.
Around about this time, about 2005, you write that your relationship with your dad, which had always been pretty cool, broke down pretty badly. What happened there?
He made some choices that, yeah, wasn't very good choices, and he and my mum split, which I was really upset about because I was always very close to mum. I was not living nearby. She needed support. She was still not well. Even though she lived for another 20, whatever it was, years, she was not well that whole time. She had to go to checkups. A lump would appear. She'd be on chemo. She wasn't well the whole time. She just fought. And I thought it was pretty bad that she was left on her own. I was very upset about it, to be honest. So,
and what happened when you told him?
Well, he kind of made excuses and deflected a lot and actually blamed us for a lot of things. And I did this for you. And he lived and breathed motorsport. And I felt like he was worried about losing that, not his family, which also hurt as well.
It's a generally pretty unhappy time. But then the following year in 2006, you moved to Ford Performance Racing, where you were much happier and felt much more supported. You and Renee moved to Melbourne. And then we get to 2007 Bathurst. It's one of the wildest ends to Bathurst that I've ever seen. Rain's coming down. 15 laps out from the end, you're in front. Cars, though, are starting to slip and slide on the slick road surface into the barriers. Tell me what happened next from your point of view inside your car.
It was a bad day. I had a bad couple of years there, and then, yeah, 2007. I actually was leading by 25 seconds before the safety car and before the weather. So we had that race wrapped up, which Bathurst, you never have it wrapped up because that's Bathurst. But 15 laps to go, 25 seconds in front, a car spun at the cutting, caused the safety car, which was fine, still in control. We had a very fast car. And then it started to sprinkle with rain. The sprinkles of rain got heavier and heavier and heavier. And I was leading. I was the pioneer. But I'd never been to Bathurst in the wet. So that was my first time I'd been to Bathurst on a greasy track, leading the biggest race, 15 laps to go. I pulled a gap on the restart, and going into the chase at 300 kilometres an hour, I hit the white line just on the outside and the car spat sideways and went through the gravel trap. It was one of the scariest rides I've had in a supercar, but it came out the other side. I landed, I bounced through and somehow regathered in fourth position and drove off. But that incident had caused a buckled rim, which put me out of the race, had to come into pit, and that was it. And that was one of the hardest moments in the race car, because when the team let you down or mechanically or something happens that's out of your hands, it's okay because it's not on you. But when, you know, the team's trying to win their first race, we led all weekend, we led all day, and I made the mistake. That was really tough. That in lap after the race, I was very flat. Like, I just felt like the world had sort of collapsed and I'd missed the opportunity.
You had three lovely boys with Renee, and in 2011, you were cast in the Pixar movie Cars 2. You were cast as Frosty, an Aussie race car in it. Wow. That must have been wild for you, something you never would have expected in your wildest dreams, being brought in to read the lines for an Australian race car called Frosty.
It was really cool. Supercars needed a family fun zone ambassador. They chose me, and that was with Mac the Transporter. And then we were talking to Disney, and they slipped a, oh, what do you think about being in a Cars 2 movie? Just off the cuff. And straight away, yep, we want in. We want in. How do we get in? We kept chasing. Like, we pushed really hard for it. But they got it all approved very quickly. And within a couple of weeks, I was down at South Melbourne Studios in the recording studio doing a voiceover to a pretty well a hand-sketched drawing, almost like when you do it on the paper and you flick it together and the car moves.
Oh,
it was
yeah.
Like,
yeah.
It was like that. It was very basic.
And how natural did they want your voice to be? Did they want you to put on an accent or what?
This is the funny thing, because I was on there with the producer. So the main producer, he was in a singlet, he was in board shorts, and he had a VB. And he goes, righto, Frosty, I'm not Australian, but I'm trying to look Australian. Am I, like, you know, on a Zoom call? And I'm like, mate, it's very Australian. You look very good. So he was just very calm and just, he knew what he was doing. It was very cool. But it's funny, when Lightning does his, you know, hey, Frosty, right, in the American voice, straight away you start putting on this American voice back. And he goes, mate, what are you doing? We want an Australian car. We don't need some Aussie trying to do this American accent thing. So he goes, look at me. I'm in my singlet. I'm in my board shorts. We're at nice. The bar. Chat to me. And I did the line and he goes, perfect. It was 30 minutes and we were done. So
it's a shame bizarre. It's a shame you couldn't throw in a yeah, nah there.
Like, yeah.
Yeah, nah, it's yeah, good, yeah.
Hey, Cobber, yeah. Yeah.
By now your mum was very ill in her last days, but was she able to meet her first grandson, your son Oliver?
She did. And this is where I think, you know, she fought really hard and she wanted to see my sister get married, my sister have kids, myself get married, and myself have kids. And Oliver was 9 weeks old, 8 weeks old. He was a tough baby. He had reflux, so he was a very big vomiter, and he was always in pain and crying. And
they're all just big vomiters, Mark.
Oh, he was messy. He was very messy. So, yeah. So Mum was in Nepean Hospital having treatment, and we took Oliver in, and she's like, he's perfect. He vomited on her. He was just crying. I'm like, oh, my goodness. But that was Mum to a T, you know. If you're part of a family and you're good to her, she will find all the good traits in you and just sort of block out all the stuff.
Yeah.
It was really nice to see that connection. And that's one of the saddest things. She would have been really proud of how my three boys have grown up. They're all really good kids. And when you lose your mum, that's the worst part. Selfishly, you want to see them. See your first child, your second child, your third child. There's always something that they're going to miss, but I'm so grateful that she got to meet Oliver and see that we were okay. It was like a sense of, you've got this, yep, my job's done. She felt at ease, I think. She'd seen everything she wanted to see.
So now we come to 2013. You had a start at Bathurst once again. This, for me, I have to say, Mark, is the most thrilling duel I think I've ever seen in Australian motorsport. I think this is extraordinary. Did it feel like it might be your day on the day?
It felt like it was going to be a good day, but I'd realised pretty quickly it's not your day till you cross the finish line. I've been there so close and haven't come through with the win. So I knew we were a good chance, and with 67 laps to go, we were in the lead. We were covered. Wincup and myself, in the last 67 laps, we were covered by 1.5 seconds. That was the biggest gap that I had in that last 67 laps. So, you know, you think about all these things. You pit. Is the pit stop going to be okay? Have we cross-threaded a wheel nut? Am I going to speed in pit lane? Did I cross the line too quick? Did the fuel hose connect properly? Don't stall on exit. Like, all these factors in the pits, you hope, were covered. And then you're on track. You know, is there safety car? Is it going to rain? a car just dropped oil. There were so many things going on. So I never think Bathurst is your day until you cross the line.
Until it is. The other thing it had was that it was a classic, maybe one of the last of these, Ford versus Holden moment. You in the Ford, Jamie Wincup in the Holden. And he's right behind you in that final lap, almost bumper to bumper, travelling at close speeds close to, what, 300 kilometres an hour? How are you holding him off? How do you do that in your head, being mindful of the track ahead, what's coming up, the turns, the curves and everything else, at the same time holding off this beast that's roaring up behind you, flashing his lights to distract you, doing all kinds of tricks like that to try and find the slightest opening to get ahead of you in the final lap?
I actually felt really comfortable. It's bizarre because when you're in the car, you feel, you know where your strengths are, you know where his weaknesses are, you know where you're vulnerable, where you're strong. So I actually felt really good. I've struggled when I watch it back because you're not in control when you're watching. It's a weird sensation, but I felt really calm. The one thing that was putting me off, though, was my team on the radio. I could feel their intensity because when the engineer, and it's the only the engineer that talks to you, like my engineer, so we have one-way communication between him and myself. So he was on the radio and his calming words in his head were eyes forward, eyes forward. That's what he kept telling me. And I'm like, I know where to look. Like, just leave me alone. I'm okay. And then in the background, I could hear voices from other crew. Is he okay? What are we, like, I could feel the tension from the garage in my car. And that was the only thing that started to make my shoulders feel a bit heavy because I felt in control. But when they're anxious, I'm like, well, why are they anxious? Like, I've got this. When I saw Wincup behind, I didn't want to be vulnerable. On the last lap, I needed to be on my terms, not on his terms, going into the chase or into the final corner. You don't want to be vulnerable. So coming out of turn one, he was behind me flashing his lights, like he said, and it actually was good because I could see where he was going without having to watch him. So again, I used that as a, oh, thanks for doing that. That's a good thing. It's not a pressure. It's helping me. So at turn two, I had a plan to push him wide. That was on my radar for the last 20 laps. If we're leading here, last lap, I'm going to lift. I'm going to push him on the outside. He's going to go wide. I'm going to get a couple of car lengths lead, and we're going to bring this thing home. And he took the bait.
How did you bait him?
Well, I lifted off the throttle, moved right, and he went around the left with a lot of momentum and got incentive. I knew he would do that. And at the 12-hour earlier that year, a guy tried to pass around the outside and went wide, and I saw you couldn't do it, so I'd watched another category, and thankfully it worked 100% to plan, gave me 5-car-length lead, and got to drive in that in-lap to finish the race, all the blue flags going, and it had been a few years since Ford had won. I think it was like a 7-year drought or something since Ford had won. Seeing all the Ford flags, driving in, getting on the radio saying, hey guys, we've won Bathurst. Like, just the emotion and enjoying that lap without the pressure of a car behind you was amazing. And to win it and cross that line and know that we beat, you know, he's been one of my arch rivals, but one of the best in the business, one of the best teams. We weren't handed the victory. We had to fight. We went head to head and we come out on top. That was one of the most satisfying moments to cross that finish line. That was really, really cool. And then you drive into pit lane. That was the first ever race win at Bathurst for Tickford Racing. The crew just hugging you and crying and the emotion. It's a very, very special place. And crossing that line, I'll never forget that moment.
It was said that there's a lot of respect between you and Jamie Wincup, but not much love. And I don't know, watching you win that, it reminded me of that. I can't remember who it was. It might have been an AFL coach who said that the sweetest feeling in the world is to beat Collingwood in a grand final, but by 1 point. It really does strike me. Like, when you have a football grand final, whether it's NRL or AFL, the winning and losing teams are very gracious towards each other and they acknowledge each other's good game. But it's really interesting watching at the end of that race, third place, second place people on the podium, when they made their speeches, didn't acknowledge you. They didn't acknowledge each other and they're acting like they've won. Almost. It's a strange thing. It's a different kind of vibe in motorsport, isn't it?
It is a different vibe. I think we all respect each other very heavily, but I don't know. For me, I race for the team. Everyone else doesn't exist. They're the enemy. It's a weird way to look at people. And when you retire, you lose that. You actually see good in all these people. And you actually, like the people I've raced against, I see their weaknesses, not their strengths when you race them, because you're trying to dissect them to beat them. But when you retire, you actually realize that you have a lot in common. They're good people, but you have to see that to compete against them. It's not a nice trait. But on that podium, when you get called up and you get that trophy and you stand in the middle, it doesn't matter what they say or who's there. You're just in this little, I don't know, glory moment of just you and your teammate standing up arm in arm, holding that cup that you fought so hard for.
2015, you won the V8 Supercars Championship and you pretty much set out to do everything you ever wanted to do and hoped you might do in motorsports. You've got a lovely family. And if anything, actually, after you won Bathurst, the only person in the world who looks happier than you and your co-driver, Richo, is Renee, your wife. She's so happy. She's so happy for you and happy for everyone. It's a really lovely thing. You've had this lovely life coming out of very difficult circumstances. Do you remind yourself of that? Do you still go and visit the old family home in Doonside out of Western Sydney?
Yeah, I do. I do. I drive. So Sydney Motorsport Park in Sydney, when we race there, is about 5 minutes from my house where I grew up on Nellie Stewart Drive. So every year I go to Sydney, I drive past. And it's just an appreciation, I guess, of seeing what you had, where you're from, to appreciate it. Because Doonside was a tough area and people are doing it tough there. But it was home and it's what I knew. I love my childhood. I had a really good upbringing. I had a very loving mum and a lot of support there. I had good friends. We went to school and our outlet was sport. We'd play soccer, we'd play footy. It was a really good place to grow up. So I've got nothing but good memories from there. So I'll drive past, but even my kids, I'll take them there. And when they complain that they don't have the latest Xbox or they don't have whatever it is, I drive past home. And I say, just so you know, that's where I grew up. That's my house. And Xboxes weren't a part of that house. So if you want to live there, we can live this way, or you can appreciate what you got, because you have to appreciate everything you get in life. Nothing's ever given. You have to work hard. And it's a reminder for me when I drive past home that the sacrifice my family made, the hard work that went into it, you never forget that.
Mike, it's been so lovely speaking with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. No, it's great to be on and really appreciate it. Thank you.
Mark Winterbottom's book is called Frosty. Today's conversation with Mark Winterbottom was made on the lands of the Gadigal people. Producers Mickey Morris, executive producer is Nicola Harrison. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.